Who are
Candice, Kelly, Jodie and Jeff, and they're speaking on the efficacy of specific dry needling techniques in the treatment of myofascial pain syndrome, and the supervisors are Dr. Jodie Wooten and Dr.
Thank you for the introduction, Elizabeth. So as Elizabeth has mentioned, our systematic reviews on the efficacy of specific dry needling techniques in the treatment of myofascial pain syndrome. So our objectives are to evaluate the efficacy of available invasive dry needling techniques for the treatment of persons diagnosed with myofascial pain syndrome and or myofascial trigger points. Also, to identify gaps in current research and provide guidance for future studies, and to relate findings to best practice, so to the real world. Myofascial pain syndrome is a condition characterized by the presence of myofascial trigger points. Travell and Simons define trigger points as hyperirritable areas located on a taut band of skeletal muscle that elicit pain when stretched or compressed. So trigger points can exhibit sensory, motor, and autonomic changes. For example, the sensory effects include local tenderness and referral of pain, which can lead to peripheral and or central sensitization. Motor effects include disturbed function in the muscle of origin and related muscles, as well as muscle weakness, stiffness, restricted range of motion, poor coordination, and muscle imbalance. The autonomic effects include localized sweating, vasoconstriction and dilation, as well as pilomotor activation. So common treatment for myofascial pain syndrome consists of two steps. First step is to deactivate the trigger point. This is done either by an invasive technique or a non-invasive technique. Invasive techniques include dry needling, acupuncture, IMS, and wet needling, which is injection of a substance into the area. And non-invasive techniques include ischemic compression, spray and stretch, laser, myofascial release, as well as manual therapy and massage. The second step is to correct or remove the precipitating or predisposing stimuli, for example, to correct postural faults or to manage things such as structural leg length discrepancies. So when we're talking about dry needling techniques, we're referring to all needling therapies except wet needling. And dry needling itself is an individual technique which involves the simple insertion and removal of an acupuncture type needle following anatomical and biological principles. So the needle can be inserted superficially into the subcutaneous tissue or deep into the trigger point itself. Whereas acupuncture is needling at acupoints along meridians and extra meridians to relieve the associated pain. And intramuscular stimulation also follows anatomical and biological principles and involves the manipulation of the inserted needle until a local twitch response is attained. So myofascial pain syndrome is a very common source of musculoskeletal complaints. It has been a disease rate prevalence has been reported to be in 1998 of 11.3% in about 2,500 subjects from the general population. And this has shown to have been increasing in prevalence in recent years. We couldn't find any Canadian statistics, but the estimated cost of chronic pain in America is $100 billion per year. This is a huge cost to the healthcare system as well as the individual. And those suffering from myofascial pain syndrome have increased morbidity and decreased quality of life. So why do we need the systematic review? Well, needling therapies are growing in popularity amongst clinicians, resulting in a need for scientific support. So if we can provide strong evidence, it can give them a good tool to make better clinical decisions. If strong evidence can support a positive effect of needling therapies, they may become accepted as a standard form of treatment in primary healthcare settings. That's where right now it's deemed an alternative treatment and not used in those settings. So when deciding on the focus of a present review, we looked at the available evidence, and in particular these three systematic reviews. A review by Cummings and White in 2001 looked at invasive needling techniques, and they found that wet needling therapy is not therapeutically superior to dry needling in reduction of pain. And they also had inconclusive evidence to support the effect of needling therapies beyond placebo. Since the literature search for this study was done about 10 years ago, we figured that additional high-quality studies should be available. A review by Rickards in 2006 looked at the non-invasive treatment of myofascial pain. They were also unable to provide strong evidence for any treatment interventions. But since this was fairly recent, we figured more time is required to generate additional studies. And the final review that we really focused on was by Ferlin et al. In 2005, which looked at acupuncture or dry needling in the treatment of nonspecific low back pain. And they had no firm conclusions, as most of their studies were of low methodological quality. This review focused on acupuncture, and their search criteria were not limited to subjects with myofascial pain or specific to pain in the low back region. So this is distinct from the parameters of our systematic review.
I'm going to be discussing some of the methods. First, in order to find articles to include into our systematic review, we reviewed numerous literature databases, including Embase, Medline, PubMed, CINAHL, Pedro, as well as the Cochrane Library Database of Systematic Reviews. We also hand-searched through the systematic reviews Jody just mentioned, as well as the reference section of our included studies. Here's an example of our search strategy we used for the Embase. Essentially what we did was take condition keywords like myofascial pain syndrome, myofascial pain, trigger points, and added them to intervention type keywords, including acupuncture, needling therapies, dry needling, intramuscular stimulation, as well as all short forms. For a study to be included into our review, it must involve adults age 16 years or older. There must be a diagnosis of myofascial pain syndrome and or its characteristic associated myofascial trigger points. In the text of the study, it must clearly define the myofascial pain and or the trigger point as per the Trevelyan and Simons description. We included randomized controlled trials, clinical controlled trials, quasi-experimental trials, where the assessments of outcome measures needed to be blinded if it's feasible. At least one intervention group had to include an invasive needling technique, whether it be dry needling, acupuncture, or IMS, or any variation of the above. And at least there had to be at least one standardized measure of pain. For example, the visual analog scale, the Roland-Meyer questionnaire, the McGill pain questionnaire, or pain pressure threshold via algometry. And of these, there needed to be pre- and post-test values. Our studies were excluded if the patients involved were diagnosed with temporomandibular joint dysfunction or fibromyalgia. Also, patients that were diagnosed with myofascial pain as a direct result of a surgical procedure were excluded. And also, studies that looked at wet needling interventions but didn't compare them with a dry needling intervention were also excluded, as dry needling is the focus of this review. Also, patients with coexisting cognitive impairments, for example, strokes, were included. And studies with low quality assessments on the Pedro score, i.e. less than 4, were also excluded. So for quality assessment, we use the Physiotherapy Evidence Database Quality Assessment Tool, which is an 11-item quality assessment measure. Each study was graded by 2 assessors independently, with conflicts between the 2 being brought to the group for consensus. Assignments of the studies were graded as excellent, being 9 to 11, good being a score of 6 to 8, fair being a score of 4 or 5, and poor being a score of less than 4. For data extraction, we compiled our own tool to be comprehensive enough to include all the descriptive information of the study, including the description of the trial, the subject characteristics, the description of the intervention, as well as its methodology, and also to include the quantitative results. Much like the quality assessment, the data extraction was completed by 2 assessors independently. Our initial title search yielded 921 titles, from which we systematically reduced down to 45 articles that were selected for a full text review. Of these, 13 met our inclusion criteria. And of these 13 studies, the interventions in them included dry needling, intramuscular stimulation, acupuncture, both traditional Chinese and Japanese, as well as superficial and deep, and variations of the above. For the subject characteristics, the average age range of the population was 32 to 79 years, and 9 of the trials looked at trigger points in the neck and upper trapezius region, while 2 looked at the lumbar region, 1 in the gluteal region, and 1 article didn't specify. The Pedro quality scores, 8 were deemed of high quality, 4 of moderate quality, and 1 was of fair quality. So for data synthesis, we not only looked at the statistical measures come up by the authors of the study, but we calculated effect sizes to measure the strength of the relationship between the 2 variables. We applied the effect sizes to the similar scale that our other systematic review authors have used. The effect sizes were calculated using RevMan version 5.0 at a 95% confidence interval, using the standardized mean difference as the effect measure, which was termed by RevMan as the Hedges adjusted G. Effect sizes were calculated at 2 different time periods, between baseline and the end of treatment, to look at the immediate effects of the intervention, and baseline to follow-up to look at the lasting effects of the intervention. Now, to separate our studies for groupings for data synthesis, they were separated into four distinct categories. One was the needling interventions versus control. Second, the needling interventions versus another intervention, or a needling intervention plus an adjunct therapy versus the adjunct therapy alone versus a control. And finally, one study that had a needling intervention without a comparison group.
So our first major group is needling intervention versus a control group. And within this, we have two separate subgroups for analysis. Studies that compared dry needling with a placebo control showed, in general, no significant difference between dry needling and the control group. The first was Ilvildu in 2004, which examined dry needling 20 subjects in each treatment group, and this was for application in the upper trapezius muscle, one treatment session per week over 4 weeks. Hugman et al. Also evaluated dry needling for the hamstring and gluteal region. This was an all-male athlete study, so it's somewhat distinct from the rest of our subject comparisons. When we're looking at acupuncture versus placebo control, three of the four studies had results which favored acupuncture, and in each individual results, there was favorable differences at treatment and follow-up. Ernick et al. In 2001, where five treatments over 3 weeks showed the favorable result versus sham laser. When we're looking, Ernick in 2002, switched them up. 2001 was the only one with non-significant results, and 2002 was the one that favored acupuncture with significant results. Ido et al. And showed the same with acupuncture and sham acupuncture, and this was one treatment over 3 weeks. Lastly was Birch et al., which had a very large significant difference in favor of acupuncture. However, we have to remember that this version of acupuncture was somewhat distinct in the fact that there was copper wiring and silicon diodes that were used in addition to just the acupuncture needles, and so this introduces the confounding variable which could increase the positive results seen.
So here we have the forest plots indicating the effect sizes of the dry needling versus control group. The top plot looks at the end of treatment pain scale values. For the plot itself, the title or the authors are indicated on the left and the forest plot on the right. In the plot itself, the effect sizes are indicated by the green dots and the confidence intervals by the whiskers extending. For each forest plot, any effect size that lands on to the left of the zero line favors the experiment, in this case the dry needling, and any effect size on the right favors control. So on the top one, at end of treatment, three studies, you know, stick out as having large significant effect sizes, and that's Birch 1998, which, as Kelly mentioned, was comparing acupuncture with coupling of silicone diodes, copper wiring, and heat lamps to a control. In contrast to what Kelly found or stated with the author's test of significance, Ernick 2001, in this measure, calculated a strong and large significant effect size. Ido 2006, which compared acupuncture to a control, again, large significant effect sizes. For follow-up measurements, for the articles that chose to measure at follow-up, Birch and Ido both retained their large significant effect sizes, while all others remained insignificant.
So when we're looking at needling intervention versus other intervention, we had to create six subgroups. There was a lot of heterogeneity with respect to the intervention. So the first is comparing to dry needling. And again, we have someone who's come up with his own unique version of dry needling. So it's called FUS subcutaneous needling. And he compared needling along the muscle fibers versus across the muscle fibers and found no significant difference between groups. However, both groups showed significant improvement over the course of treatment. And when we're comparing two different acupuncture techniques, Birch and Jameson, which we know from before, showed significant results compared what they call relevant versus irrelevant acupuncture, and that's just with respect to where they were needling in accordance with the affected muscle. And he found that relevant acupuncture was significantly favorable to irrelevant. And then Cecchirelli et al. Compared superficial with deep acupuncture. Superficial being the insertion of the needle 1.2 millimeters below the skin surface, and deep acupuncture was 1.5 centimeters below the skin surface. And while there was no significant difference at post-treatment, at 3 months follow-up, deep acupuncture was favored. And then when we're comparing dry needling with acupuncture, goes back to the study by Ernick et al., which favored acupuncture for the reduction of motion-related pain at the end of treatment. Now, when we look to dry needling versus wet needling techniques, for these three studies, wet needling was either lidocaine injection or Botox injection. Kamanlia et al. And Hong favored lidocaine injection over dry needling, and this was just a single treatment session, and they looked at post-treatment reduction of pain scores and increase in pain pressure threshold. And both Kamanlia et al. And Hong favored lidocaine. When we look at Gaw, who looked at IMS versus lidocaine injection, and this was three treatment sessions over 3 weeks, actually favored IMS for the increase in pain pressure threshold at follow-up, and there was no significant difference between groups and any other measure taken. The last two groups, comparison of acupuncture versus conventional massage. This was the study done by Ernick et al. In 2001, showed a significant difference in favor of acupuncture for the reduction of motion-related pain post-treatment. However, there was no follow-up taken. When we're comparing dry needling and laser, this was Ilvoldu et al., showed a significant difference in favor of laser for all three outcome measures taken. However, in this study, laser treatments were three times more often than dry needling treatments, so it skews the results somewhat.
So here we have the forest plots depicting the effect sizes for the dry needling versus other intervention. On this first slide here, we have the end of treatment effect sizes for pain scales and pain pressure threshold. For pain scales, we can see only one study there. The Ernick 2001 showed a very large significant effect in favor of acupuncture over the massage, whereas the others tended to affect the other treatment. Brad especially would be interested to know, with Ilvoldu 2004, looked at the difference in laser compared to dry needling and found strong, significant effect sizes in favor of laser therapy. Kamanli found strong, significant effect sizes again in favor of the Botox and the lidocaine. In the pain pressure threshold, it's found that Ilvoldu again carried over his large significant effect size in favor of laser, while all others remained insignificant. This is in contrast to what Kelly just said, where Kamanli statistically found in their study Botox and lidocaine having a statistically significant effect. However, the effect sizes were found to be insignificant for both. Here we have the follow-up measurements for, again, the studies that chose to provide follow-up scores. Hong, as Kelly stated, retained its large significant effect size post-follow-up in favor of lidocaine, whereas PPT, for pain pressure threshold, none of the studies showed significant difference. Again, this, with GA 2007, is in contrast to what the authors found, where it was shown to be significant.
So our next group is a study by Edwards and Knowles, which compared superficial dry needling in addition to stretch alone, and to controls. With this group, treatment sessions varied depending on severity of condition, but they didn't specify number per subject based on severity. So we just know that treatment sessions were variable in this study. So no significant difference between groups immediately post-treatment. However, superficial dry needling and stretch were favored at follow-up for the increase in pain pressure threshold versus stretch. And then versus control, superficial dry needling and stretch were favored in the reduction of pain on the McGill pain questionnaire at follow-up. And then lastly, a single low-quality study by Kung et al., which looked at a 3-week course of treatment for traditional acupuncture. He used a pair t-test analysis to show a significant reduction in the VAS pain scale. However, there was no comparison group for this study.
Okay, for the discussion, We're going to look at the trends that we found from the results, as well as taking a closer look at the study designs and see how that may have affected the results. So studies that had a large effect size in favor of needling interventions shared a common trait of having multiple needling treatments. And these studies were Birch and Jameson, Ernich and al., 2001, and Ido and al., and all of these studies had at least one time needling treatment one times per week for 3 weeks. And so this trend may indicate that multiple treatments in the clinical setting may be needed for a successful management of myofascial pain syndrome. Also, Birch and Jameson identified a high correlation between previous acupuncture treatments and the reduction in visual analog scale scores. So with this one, just to go back to the large effect sizes of those three that had multiple treatments, it's important to note that the Birch and Jameson study and the Ido and al. Study both had, although they had large effect sizes, they also had quite large confidence intervals, and that actually impairs the repeatability of the effects. So you want to keep that in mind. So again, going back to the high correlation between previous acupuncture treatments and the reduction of VAS scores in the Birch and Jameson study, they found that despite randomization, 40% of the subjects in the treatment group had previous acupuncture treatment compared to 13% in the control group. And when they did a calculation without these subjects involved, they found that acupuncture was no longer significantly better at reducing pain. So this may indicate that a preconceived view does have an effect on outcome. And if it does, then it may have been creating a placebo effect that was making the treatment group more favorable. Or this could just mean when they took out the subjects that the sample size was not large enough anymore to detect a change. However, if it is, it can be looked at negatively that there was a higher number of patients that had previous experience in the treatment group. And this could be considered a design flaw, but it also could be looked upon like clinically that if there is some sort of placebo effect that you could, that education may be important in making sure that these people have very good understanding before they're getting the treatment to help with favorable results. Also, we're going to look at the design flaws within these studies in the needling versus needling intervention versus control group. And we found that within Birch and Jameson, the one that had the copper diodes and the heat lamps involved, that creates the confounding variables and make it difficult to determine if needling was the sole cause of the positive effects. Also, in Ernich et al. 2001, the sample contained mixed diagnoses of myofascial pain syndrome, irritation syndrome, and cervical segmental dysfunction. Now, the authors did complete a subgroup analysis, but they didn't determine that the treatment group and the control group within this subgroup analysis were equal at baseline, so that skews the results. Also, with Ido and al., they originally had 26 subjects in the crossover trial, but they had 7 dropouts, and they did not perform an intention to treat analysis. So this causes attrition bias, and the small sample size will decrease the power of the study. So, therefore, although significant results are present and achieve large effect sizes, the design flaws may question the strength of the results themselves. So, moving on to look at needling versus needling intervention. So, there were some promising results that came out of these studies that Kelly had mentioned, that acupuncture seems to be more effective than dry needling. And deep needling and needling the more relevant acupuncture points seems to be more effective. However, we could not come up with any trends through these three studies because of the heterogeneity. So future research will need to be done to substantiate these findings. Okay, so then looking at needling versus other intervention. So in comparing dry needling to lidocaine injections, which is considered wet needling, Hong and Kamanli found lidocaine to be favored. So this actually differs from the findings from the systematic review by Cummings and White, who found there was no significant difference between dry needling and wet needling treatments in the decrease in pain intensity. So looking at that, we found that Hong and Kamanli et al. Only involved one dry needling treatment versus one lidocaine injection. Now, this is a problem because dry needling can actually be accompanied by post-treatment soreness, and lidocaine is an analgesic. So in that situation where you're only involving one and looking at that initial follow-up, it kind of makes sense that lidocaine was more favorable. However, if you look at Gaw et al., which favored IMS over lidocaine injections, they had multiple treatments, so three treatments over 3 weeks. Also, it's important to note that dry needling and IMS are different in that IMS has that the manipulation of the needle once it's inserted to get that local twitch response. So the form of dry needling may be playing a role in the treatment efficacy. Also, so to look at the dry needling versus laser with Ilvildu, as Kelly had mentioned, laser was favored. However, the laser group received significant more treatments, and that was laser had three treatments per week for 4 weeks, where dry needling only had one treatment per week for 4 weeks. So the lack of standardization of the treatment application introduces a systematic error of performance bias. So going into the limitations of this review, to start off, is publication bias. So we were unable, due to it being too costly, to translate any articles in different languages that may have been able to be included in this review. And also, we found that, so with that, acupuncture is a traditional Chinese medicine. So there's probably quite a few studies that we missed that were in Chinese journals. Also, we completed our lit search in August 2007. Therefore, additional relevant articles may be available now. In looking at the quality assessment tool that we use, Pedro, we found that there's quite a few high-quality studies. However, when you got in depth into looking at the studies, you found that there were some pretty serious design flaws. So looking at that, the Pedro scale, it only looks at rating internal validity of the trial and whether it contains sufficient statistical information to make it interpretable. But it does not rate the external validity of the trial or size of the treatment effect. And also, the Pedro scale was designed to actually rate the quality of randomized control trials, where we did not have solely randomized control trials in our review. So maybe finding a more appropriate quality assessment tool may have changed the actual quality of our studies. Now, looking at the heterogeneity of the studies, which is a big issue, is that it was difficult to perform a meaningful meta-analysis because of this. There is many differences among control groups, sample populations, outcome measures, and the type of intervention that was used. So another limitation was manipulation of data. In three of our studies, which were Birch and Jameson, Hugwinen, and Ernich and all 2001, we had to transfer information over from box plots and from graphs in order to calculate our effect sizes, and this leads to a risk of translation error that could affect our results. Also, in terms of diagnostic criteria for myofascial pain syndrome, there is no universally accepted classification criteria for myofascial pain syndrome, but it is most commonly defined by Treval and Simons. However, not all studies use this criteria, therefore it was difficult to compare treatment responses and may affect the validity of the review. Okay, so in terms of implications for research, we found that there is definitely a need for more high-quality studies, there needs to be a standardization of research and treatment methods so we don't have as much heterogeneity and you can start to develop more trends. And also in terms of the treatment methods, with control groups, we had sham acupuncture, medication, and as well as sham laser, where it's actually just starting to come out by authors, actually, Streitberger and Kleinhans have determined that there is the placebo acupuncture needle has shown to be sufficiently credible to be used in acupuncture and needling research now. So if research could actually, studies could go towards using that more, it would actually we'd be able to draw stronger conclusions from the research. Also, real-life treatment plans incorporated into the study designs would be effective for being able to transfer the results into the clinical setting, and consistent timing of outcome measures, including end of treatment and long-term follow-up measures, would be very beneficial. 6 of the 13 studies only had follow-up measures, and this is very important in terms of needling techniques, because as I had mentioned before, there is a chance for post-treatment soreness with needling techniques. So if we had, even if it was 1 week later showing follow-up, not just immediately after, you might be able to tease out more along the lines of whether or not lidocaine or the dry needling techniques are more effective. And also, it's important that if studies could begin to look more at other outcomes, such as quality of life or just improving function with dry needling. And with implications of practice, we found that best practice does involve a structured interdisciplinary approach, including physical and cognitive behavioral strategies. And the National Institute of Health consensus statement on acupuncture concluded that it may be useful as an adjunct treatment. So we find that from this review, it indicates a need for future investigation of dry needling therapies as part of a comprehensive program and just not by itself.
So, in conclusion, though dry needling techniques have been shown to positively affect pain outcomes, there's no clear evidence that dry needling techniques are more efficacious than placebo, sham, or alternative treatment with the evidence to date. Also, no clear recommendations can be made regarding what's the most effective needling technique, whether it be acupuncture, dry needling, or IMS, and if so, what the optimal length and frequency of treatment is for best results. However, there is a trend that suggests that multiple treatment sessions are more effective on pain outcomes than single sessions, and overall, due to the heterogeneity of the studies included and the overall quality, the level of evidence for using dry needling as a technique to improve pain outcomes in myofascial pain syndrome doesn't exceed the moderate level. So, thank you very much for your attention. We'd just like to give some quick acknowledgments and special thank yous to Dr. Darlene Reed, Dr. Babak Shadgan, Charlotte Beck, Dr. Angel Bush, and as well Meredith Wilson. It was performed by two physiotherapists, and the techniques were effleurage, percussion, and just deep tissue. The two outcomes that usually presented with these studies was pain and range of motion. Not of the ones that we looked at, none of them looked at the functional outcomes.
There were some measures in some of the studies, but we decided to focus our review on pain. Yeah. Not all of them included functional outcome measures, but there were a few.
There was variability in what it stated a lot. I think there was three studies that explicitly stated a physiotherapist, and then there was, I think, two or three that said acupuncturist. And then a lot of the studies made sure to say that they had this number of years of experience and training. But there was variability amongst who was administering it.
Mm-hmm.
The authors did that.
And did they, off the top of the head, if it was just taking them out and redoing the analysis, or if it was comparing sort of like the means between the groups? Just in terms of removing subject numbers from it and rewriting a statistical analysis, you have a rule of power.
Yeah.
As opposed to comparing the groups, I'm just curious if you know.
Off the top of my head, I can't speak to that.
Acupuncture, can you elaborate on I wasn't too sure if it applied to the trigger point directly, or do they use their energy channel to get to that trigger point?
The acupuncture where they were saying, the traditional Chinese acupuncture, when it was explicitly stated, talked about the meridians and the
acupoints,
which are labeled in, they actually labeled them in Chinese, in the language. So it was more so that versus a direct.
So they would say, for example, they would go to the energy channel that's related to the upper trap.
Mm-hmm. They would label the like Shujin point, and okay. then they would, and they labeled all of the ones that they would.
Mm-hmm. Was there any comparison between direct points and
the one study which compared acupuncture and dry needling? So dry, like basically, acupuncture and dry needling involve the similar insertion, but based on the different philosophies. So when we did the results comparing acupuncture and dry needling, that's kind of the differentiation. And it favored, that single study favored acupuncture for the one single measure. But we didn't find any other studies that were comparing the two groups.
Maybe you say that, but I was just wondering if any of this is occurred at first.
There was no, when we came across them, none of them said that there was adverse effects. They did talk about post-needling soreness, but nothing that lasted beyond the next day. And there was three or four studies that I remember that explicitly stated no adverse effects, but otherwise it wasn't mentioned. It was just with respect to the location, like, of the needling point. So they would needle what they would consider a point that would affect that actual trigger point, and then they just pick somewhat random points to insert the needle.
And with your dry needling, is the trigger points that they're needling, are they specific, like, no trigger points, or is each trigger point determined on the individual basis?
Each trigger point is found through palpation and individual.
Did you find, you stated that different studies utilized different areas of the upper tract and the glutes. Was there changes in significance with different areas that were tested?
It's hard to comment because so many of them looked at the upper traps and back, whereas only one looked at the glutes and hams, and one looked at the low, or two looked at the low back, so it's really hard to.
We had this discussion too, like when we were deciding on what to focus on for our review, and what we came up with too, and what we had been, what had been suggested to us, that it's the same physiological mechanisms occurring, whether it's in your traps or low back, same type of tissue.
And it becomes difficult as well, because one of the studies that looked at the low back region was elderly patients, and then the other study that looked at gluteals and hamstrings was young male athletes, so it's kind of hard to even come to any kind of trend with respect to that.
And were all the subjects healthy, or were there any?
No. Many, like I would say all, I don't want to say 100%, but a lot of them, the exclusion criteria was listed off serious comorbidities.
You reported earlier on that your the average age ranges in the studies were, I think,
32.
Mm-hmm. So was there a study that the average age was 79?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of the points that have been mentioned in some other of the systematic reviews, I think, is still relevant to yours. And one is the issue of acuity. And even though you have control groups, if you have a control group that ended up having people who were more acute than chronic, and we know that people get better with time, spontaneous improvement in time, we always have to control for that. Your body generally going to heal in some way, and there are always the curve of the ups and downs, but ultimately we tend to get better. Mm-hmm. To what degree was this addressed, and was acuity controlled? And can you be sure that a given control group was sort of basically at a plateau level of pain and not changing compared with the other?
There was, the range was, every study I think was more than 3 months that we looked at. The one study that was acute and it didn't meet our inclusion criteria because they were post-stroke. So they were the one, they were labeled as having myofascial pain, but they were 3 weeks post-stroke, which introduces the cognitive effects. But there was anywhere up to 18 months, I think, was the top range, or five years. So it is a very large age range. They did make sure that the average length of time experiencing myofascial pain was comparable at baseline.
Between groups. And what about other treatments? Be it pharmacologic, be it Chinese herbs, be it chiropractic.
Well, many of the studies controlled for those, while others didn't do such a good job. Mm-hmm. For example, Birch et al., both groups were on concurrent analgesics. They prescribed not only the heat lamps and the silicone diodes, but analgesics as well, and that was a trend that's scattered all over the studies. So some stated that no other treatment within a certain time frame, no other medications used. Well, again, others didn't.
But in general, it can be addressed by a variety of the health profession, all of addressing the predisposing and the precipitating factors can be done by a chiropractor, by a massage therapist and that sort of thing. So I think in general, this condition can be addressed by many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just finding even clinically that it used to be, well, what's the medical management, what's the surgical management? Mm-hmm. Now tell me about your traditional Chinese medical practitioner, about your massage therapist. Mm-hmm. Recently, yes, the naturopath and the chiropractor. Mm-hmm. There were several. And we all seem to be working and doing our thing together, mm-hmm. but I think we have to
Definitely, and that was one of our implications for research. Definitely needs to be kind of incorporated into a comprehensive program and not just looked at in isolation.
I wonder if you'd comment on, I think one of you made the point that, well, one treatment, modality was one time a week and another was three or four times a week or something. But do you think that seems sort of arbitrary, the fact that we need these standardized. Maybe, we need to look at, well, one time a week for each modality, twice a day, once every 2 weeks, to kind of get a sense of what their curative healing properties are. I mean, is it really fair to think that they're all going to be, we all have to standardize to 3 times a week? Maybe that's not how it optimally works. I think 3 times a week is basically Monday, Wednesday, Friday, mm-hmm. and has more to do with our work week than anything therapeutic.
Definitely. It's hard to come up with an optimal frequency, mm-hmm. but for the sake of a study, I think there is that kind of even that effect of having to go to a treatment more often that you think that you are getting better and you are getting treated more. Rather, and there is just that kind of placebo of having undergone a treatment once a week versus 3 times a week.
But I think that's something we have to give a lot of thought to in these kinds of
definitely.
A couple more things. One is the effect size. Mm-hmm. Your categories weren't mutually exclusive, and I couldn't quite flash back. You had 0.2 to 0.5, next one 0.5 to 0.8, next one. That doesn't work, and I'm trying to think. I couldn't quite remember what the original scale was. But
well, anything like an effect size of 0.2 is considered small.
Mm-hmm. But what about 0.5?
0.5 is considered moderate.
So it should have been.
But though it's the end of the.
Yeah, it should have been 4.9.
Yes. I understand these are very arbitrary, but it adds to the further arbitrariness, when it comes to separating those out. The other thing about, if you publish this, I think in your title you'll have to say that it's pain and that it's not myofascial pain syndrome, because the syndrome, as you correctly described, a syndrome is a collective, it's a composite of a range of things, and in fact, this was really directed to the pain itself. I mean, it seems like a small point, but do you see what I'm saying, is that you didn't have really outcomes on all the other aspects of the syndrome, so you might want to consider that. And my last question, what causes myofascial syndrome?
Well, it's a combination of factors. Like Jody had stated, it's often precipitated by poor biomechanics, muscle imbalance, that over time these things develop into this myofascial syndrome. As for the exact mechanism and physiology of how it works, there's a number of theories that discuss how a band of muscle has become taut and what leads to this hypersensitive area, but there haven't been any real firm conclusions. Are all just theoretical at this point. But from what we've read, it seems like a lot of people in the population have it, but they're brought out by these ergonomic biomechanical stressors.
What's its natural course if it's untreated? I mean, does it heal? Does it go away? Does it become more chronic? What's the natural history?
I think it depends on if you take away the precipitating factors as well, because it, like we'd said, it can develop into a centralization of pain, and it can become worse as it goes if it isn't treated.
So. There's often a cycle of it going through activity and latency, like Julie described. The active trigger point is one that refers pain without compression, whereas a latent trigger point, I think the majority of the class may have a latent trigger point if we look hard enough, where if you find a hyperirritable spot or you press it, you'll feel a preferred pain symptom.
And I think it's very individualized too. Like, why do certain people end up getting chronic pain after a fracture, after a car accident? Why is somebody who undergoes repeated ergonomic stress end up with these active trigger points that continue on to myofascial pain syndrome and become chronic? I think it's a very complex, such as a fibromyalgia or a TMJ, that we can't pinpoint an exact reason behind it.
Thank you very much.